If I were going to make the most eloquent introduction to our next speaker, all I would have to say is, ladies and gentlemen, Ron Reagan. There are some people on the planet who truly need no introduction. However, the award he's receiving tonight does need some introduction. We sent our award to Ron Reagan, the Emperor Has No Clothes Award. He lives actually here in Seattle. We sent it to him after his remarks at the memorial for his father, President Ronald Reagan, in the year 2004. And you may recall that when that happened, Ron Reagan publicly criticized politicians who wear religion on their sleeves. It was all over the New York Times. It was on page one of all the newspapers around the country. And that same summer, after an interview with Larry King, who asked Ron Reagan, would you ever consider running for public office? Do you know what he said? Do you remember what he said? He said he could never be elected because I'm an atheist. That was just one of many very public moments. Of course, someday, somebody's going to prove him wrong, right? Someday. Maybe not in the next election, but that was one of many very public moments since he was a very young man when Ron Reagan never, ever shied away from the religion question. In fact, if you heard our interview on Free Thought Radio with Ron Reagan where he talked about, I think he was 12 years old, he went to mom and dad, as he calls them so casually, and he said, I don't believe anymore. It's a fascinating interview, and he doesn't shy away from that. In fact, he was very gracious to record a radio commercial, 30-second ad for the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which ran on Air America Radio. And in that ad, voices like his are known as the talent. He had some latitude to add some of his own words in there, and he chose to add the phrase, Ron Reagan, unabashed atheist. So we're considering his remarks tonight. It's called One Boy's Journey to Godlessness, to really be an acceptance speech of the Emperor Has No Clothes Award. And this award, by the way, is manufactured exclusively for us by the company that does the Oscars. Ron represents the child in the fairy tale who said the Emperor has no clothes, the person who tells it like it is about religion, and he sure does that. He's championed stem cell research. He infuses common sense and compassion into his syndicated Air America radio show. And how many of you listened to that? The Ron Reagan Show, and in all the TV and radio shows that he has hosted and appeared on, from MSNBC to 2020 to the BBC. And Annie, Laurie, and I are really happy, after having interviewed you on our radio show, to actually meet you in person, and thank you for having the guts to tell it like it is. You told it like it is to your parents when you were a little boy, to the GOP, and to the Democrats, and to the world. And he has kindly agreed to bring the award back, because we sent it to him how many years ago, and he's brought it back with him, so that we can kind of reenact the actual physical presentation of it. So bring it up here, and we'll go ahead and do that.
Well, thank you so much. Appreciate it very much. Yes, there he is, the little imp, with his handy mirror, his little scepter. Which I think a neighbor's child has gotten to this, I think, at some point, and bent it a little bit. And, of course, his tiny little fig leaf, one of my favorite. I'll just put him right up there. All right, let me get set here. I really appreciate this, Annie and Dan and all of you, the Freedom From Religion Foundation. I certainly appreciate you having me here. It's a great pleasure to be here. I have to say, we're an odd bunch, aren't we? You know? I mean, most people get together in these sorts of things because they believe in some particular thing, and they all rally around that kind of, here we are, a bunch of non-believers. It's like, you know, gathering around an empty space or something like that. But I guess that's not entirely true, because we believe in reason, and free thought. Maybe belief is not the right way to put it, but nevertheless, we trust in reason and in free thought. I won't presume to lecture you. We just had a fascinating lecture about the good news about atheism, and I know you guys are, you know, well-versed in this sort of thing, more than I am, I have to say. I feel a little abashed, frankly, in receiving this award. I don't even feel worthy of it, in a way. I've been an atheist really almost as long as I can remember. And so I didn't put a whole lot of thought into it, and I imagine some of you have really, you know, dark nights of the soul, a lot of theological study, you really went to the mat with this kind of stuff, and I feel like an interloper or something. I just kind of, you know, at age 8 or whatever, I went, this isn't making any sense to me, forget it, and didn't really give it all that much more thought, frankly, and I have to say I was as surprised, well, maybe not as surprised as you, or maybe more surprised as you were, at the reaction to my answer to that question about are you planning to run for office. I'd been given this as a standard answer, as a way to just sort of shut down that line of inquiry. I don't want to be a politician anyway, frankly, even if I wasn't an atheist. But that I found that was the fastest way to stop that sort of conversation. You ever going to run for president? I'm an atheist. Okay. So, how about them Yankees, huh? Yeah, that would always shut that right down there. My journey it was much, much shorter. As I said, I can't remember really a time when I didn't have considerable doubt. Now, I did grow up in a religious household. It's true, but we weren't very religious, I would say. We were Presbyterian. That's what we were. Part of the great 19th century religious revival here in the United States. So no, I didn't know any of that at the time. I just, you know, my parents went to a Presbyterian church. This had to do with my father's mother, who was a member of what was called the Christian Church, which was an offshoot, as I understand it, of the Presbyterian Church. Very socially progressive, I have to say. My father's mother was, she even into her old age, when she moved out to California to be with near my father when he was an actor in Hollywood, she had a little home in Santa Monica, and my mother and father would go, this is before I was born even, would go to visit her, of course, and they'd walk into her house, and there'd be a perfect stranger sitting at the kitchen table having a meal. I'd say, "Nellie, who's that?" "Oh, just some homeless guy that she had, you know, I mean, he needed a meal. So she had him in, gave him a meal, and, you know, then he'd leave." That was you know, how they did that in those days. My father's father was a Catholic. He was raised Catholic. I'm not sure how devout a Catholic he was, devout, rather, a Catholic he was. But he did have some socially progressive ideas of his own. I remember a story that my father told me about his father, who he was a shoe salesman. Sometimes he had to travel a lot, and I think it was back in the 30s at some point. He was out on the road somewhere traveling to be to sell shoes or whatever, and he stopped late one night on a cold, windy, rainy night in a little hotel out in the Midwest where he was, and he was signing in at the front desk, and the guy at the manager of the hotel saw his name, saw Reagan, and pretty obvious Irish name, and he said, "Well, sir, you'll be happy to know that we don't allow those other people in here." Now, what he was talking about was Jews. "We don't allow any Jews in the hotel." And my grandfather understood this, that was the message that he was being given. And he said, "Well, then I guess you don't want any Catholics here either." Turned on his heel, walked out, and slept in his car that night, rather than... Now... We did go to the Presbyterian Church. We went to the Bel Air Presbyterian Church, actually. Pretty fancy schmancy. I always thought that was a little odd to begin with, because we didn't live in Bel Air. We lived out in Santa Monica. We lived miles away from Bel Air. But every Sunday, we'd get in the car. And this was, at a certain point, this was when my father was governor of California, and so it was, the car was a limousine, and it was chauffeur-driven by a policeman, a highway patrolman. But anyway, we get out there, we drive down Sunset Boulevard, and we get onto the freeway, and we drive north on the freeway, and we get off the freeway, and we drive west on Mulholland Drive. Finally, we'd get to the mall, you know, the Bel Air Presbyterian Church after about a half an hour. And then would spend 2 hours on a Sunday morning in there. Now, I don't think Catholic masses last for 2 hours. But we'd spend 2 hours from 11 in the morning, because my folks weren't big early risers on the Sunday. 11, they didn't go to the early service. 11 in the morning to 1 in the afternoon. We were in this church. There were homilies. There were benedictions. There were genuflections. There were all sorts of things that we had to do, a little musical interlude. And then the hymns would come and the choir and all this kind of stuff. And I was thinking, this is a hell of an imposition on your time on a Sunday morning. God, you know, 2 hours we've got to do this? This is crazy. And I asked my father, why do we have to go to church in the first place? I thought God was everywhere. And he said, well, he did the thing about, well, and he, you know, he'd get very kind of avuncular with you. Well, you know, God says... wherever two or more shall gather, there shall I be. I thought, okay, so if you're alone and in a real jam, what, God can't hear you anymore? What does that mean? You seem to be a God of pretty picayune rules, frankly. There's got to be more than two of you, and you got to be in this building over here. Come on, he was supposed to be everywhere, right? It's not the way you'd expect a grand, omniscient deity to behave, after all. But I went along, of course. You're a kid. What do you know? The parents want you to do this, so you just go along and you do this kind of thing. One draw was the minister at the church. His name was Don Mumma. And he was a big guy, ex-UCLA football lineman. He was an All-American at UCLA. And big, ruggedly handsome fellow, booming voice, very compelling personality, very compelling speaker, as even my father would attest. And my father, you know, no slouch in the public speaking arena. On a good day, you know, Don, he could wrap you right around his little finger. He'd have you laughing, then he'd have you crying, then he'd bring you back again, you know, and it's pretty entertaining stuff. And we'd visit with him after the service, and in person, he was just as charming and avuncular as he was up there in the pulpit, and all that. Nice wife and kids too, very nice family. A few years later, after I'd stopped attending the Bel Air Presbyterian Church, or any other church for that matter, Don was asked to step down from his post. Seems he'd been using that charm of his to woo various women in the congregation into adulterous affairs. Another example for a young person that religionists, no matter how eloquently they may talk, sometimes they talk the talk, but they don't necessarily walk the walk now, do they? But that by that time, I was long gone. Earlier in life, though, I think my history, my story was fairly typical, as in many households, I suspect. And this is really almost cliche, I realize, but Santa Claus was the great destructive torpedo of religion. You know, Santa and God have a lot in common, don't they? They both big white beards. Baritone voices, both Caucasian apparently. both have an omniscient sense of who's naughty and who's nice. Both are eager to reward or punish. If Santa can get a little cranky, you know, depriving you of your presents, leaving the lump of coal in the stocking, God seemed positively psychotic. I mean, lump of coal is one thing. That's kind of a practical joke. But I remember the first time I heard the story of Abraham and Isaac. What kind of thing is that for a little kid to hear? God wants Abraham to prove his faith by slaughtering his son Isaac like a spring lamb. Now, I wasn't too crazy about lambs being eviscerated. But a child? Are you kidding? And Abraham, he went along with this. How did this happen? It seemed to me the only proper response to a request like that from a deity would be a stiff middle finger hoisted heavenward.
And I couldn't understand why that didn't happen. I mean, can you imagine?
Oh, by the way, I'd like you to kill your child for me, just to prove that I'm, you know, that I'm your God. Well, go to hell. How about that? You know? I mean, I know, and the angel intervened, you know, at the end, so it didn't really happen and all that, but think of the psychological damage that had already been done. I mean, really. By that time, I was dimly aware that I was probably guilty in God's eyes of some sort of thought crime. What if he decided to go off on me? What if he told Dad to fillet me like a haddock? My father was a devoted Christian. I began to look at him with a little bit of suspicion. You know, who's more important, me or, you know? Now, another enemy of religion, of course, is paleontology. Or in a small child's mind, in my mind, cavemen. Cavemen, for some reason, I don't know why, at a very, very early age, I became fascinated with the notion of cavemen, of prehistoric human beings. And now, of course, I'd heard the story of Adam and Eve, and I had been told that this was real, you know, that it all started with just two people, and I'd seen the pictures, too. You know, and they looked just like the rest of us. There weren't any heavy brows or anything. They didn't seem to be wearing fur. They had some very accommodating foliage that always kind of swooped across the naughty bits. But other than that, but clearly something was amiss here. I had lots of books, you know, dinosaurs and, you know, prehistoric humans and all that kind of thing. And just how exactly did Homo erectus and Neanderthal fit into this picture with Adam and Eve? Did they come before? Did they come after? What was the deal there? I remember I was, in my memory, I'm 4, maybe 5 years old. And I'd been pondering this for a while, in my 4 or 5 year old way. And I was sitting on the floor of my room and playing with some little toy. I think it was one of these things where you could put the little plastic thing in the oven that they would give you. They'd never do this for kids anymore. They'd give a kid a little oven that could burn them. But then, like, what the hell? They don't wear helmets when they ride bikes. We, you know. And it would, like, pop into this creature. You were playing God. You were creating a little creature. So I was playing with this thing, and my mother walked in to put some stuff in my closet or whatever. I'd been thinking about this. Mommy? Yes, honey? Were Adam and Eve the first cavemen or the first people, and I was very proud of using this phrase, the first people as we know them today? I don't know where I'd heard that, but I was really proud that I could use the phrase as we know them today. So what was the deal? And my mother, my poor mother, you know, just sort of stared at me with deer in the headlight eyes. And the first people as we know them today. Oh, okay. So, I thought to myself, there was Adam and Eve, but before Adam and Eve, there were other people. All of a sudden, that whole story became a story. Not the story, just a story, all of a sudden. And I think from that moment on, my course was clear. That had knocked the pins right out of from under Christianity, as far as I could tell. Kids ask a lot of simple questions, of course, and simple questions tend to confound religionists often. If we're all God's children, why are we treating people differently? If God loves all of humanity, why did he only send Jesus to the Middle East? You know? And what's the deal with hell? Hell was a big one, too. Hell really bothered me. What the hell was up with hell? Anyway, apparently you had to be Christian to escape it. But what about the billions of people around the world who hadn't been exposed to Christianity, I thought. I mean, would some little baby thousands of miles away who had died of malaria have to spend eternity writhing in agony just because his parents were Hindu? Didn't seem fair. Seemed like God had unaccountably rigged the game. My parents had no satisfactory answer for that one. They seemed sympathetic to the little Hindu child. But apparently, rules were rules. And that little baby would have to fry in hell. And I felt myself slipping farther and farther away from their belief. And of course, there's the big question, which I'm sure all you know very well, which is, okay, if God is all-powerful and omniscient, sees all, knows all, he can do anything at any time, why is he letting little children be savagely murdered? Either he can't stop it, in which case, not all-powerful, or doesn't want to, which is a much more disturbing prospect, isn't it? That was the big one. Now, at about age 12, I decided I would no longer attend church with my parents. I actually informed my father of this one Sunday morning. The usual routine was that they would be getting ready for church. We'd all, of course, put suits on and all that kind of thing, and my father would come in and get me, and we'd go and get in the car, and off we'd go, and I in my little suit. And so that day, he walked into my room, and I wasn't wearing my little suit anymore. And I told him, I don't believe in this anymore, and I'm not going. And Dad was clearly taken aback. I mean, this was a bit of a stunner to him. But to his credit, he did not try to force me. He went off to church, and I did my thing quite happily. At home, playing or doing whatever I was doing. I knew what was going to come, though, when he got home. Nothing bad. My father never yelled at us, really, certainly never hit us or anything like that. But he would try quiet persuasion. And, in fact, that's what he did at some length, but to no avail. I was quite stubborn and had been considering my position for some time, and I was entirely unmovable on this issue. He did even enlist the services of the aforementioned minister, Don Mumoth, who was still, he hadn't gotten in trouble yet. I remember one afternoon I was at home, this was some, maybe 6 months or so after I had decided that I wouldn't go to church, and there was a knock on the door, and lo and behold, it's Don Mumoth. What are you doing here, Minister Mumoth? Well, he's been invited here to convince me to come back to the flock. He later told me years later at a wedding that he was terribly embarrassed by the whole thing, but he didn't feel like he could really refuse my father, so he came. And no go there either, though. That didn't work any better than my father's quiet persuasion. You know, once the scales fall from your eyes, there is no easy way back, even if you want it. And I didn't. I didn't want it. I don't lose much sleep over other people's beliefs, religious or otherwise. For the most part, I consider them to be none of my business, really. But when those beliefs begin to intrude into public policy, when religionists assume the right to foist their beliefs on other people or deny people civil rights based on some interpretation of Holy Writ, then it becomes all our business. Religion, religion may inspire acts of great kindness and courage. It does indeed, but it also trains people to believe things for which there is no evidence. This makes religion's intrusion into the political sphere all the more troubling. You remember the Republican presidential debate this last time around, 2004? Remember David Gregory asked it very ineptly, but he asked the question about evolution. He said, how many of you believe in evolution? Raise your hand. Well, nobody believes in evolution. There are facts that support it, and reason tells us that this seems to be the going thing. Okay, so 3 out of 10 Republican candidates raised their hand to acknowledge that they did not accept evolution. 30% of the Republican ticket does not accept this basic fundamental tenet of biology. I mean, they might as well be flat earthers. This was quite a shocking thing, but very few people made much of it. They just sort of laughed it off as if it was no big deal. Not only does this blind faith lead to scientific illiteracy, apparently, it apparently promotes a moral muddle as well. Now, you know that I've been somewhat involved with the stem cell issue. Certainly was back in 2004. I don't, by the way, if anybody's got some detailed questions about the cutting-edge stem cell research or anything, I'm probably not your guy. I'm not a scientist, and this field has moved very fast. It is doing so all the time. So, I won't be able to answer all kinds of things about that. But when it comes to politicians and stem cell research, there seems to be an element of confusion here. Now, I understand that there are some people on the anti-choice side and the anti-stem cell side who believe that any pre-embryo, any zygote, any cell that is dividing is, in fact, a human being. Okay, well, if that's what you believe, and you really do believe it, then there's no real compromise on issues like stem cell research or abortion, for that matter. I mean, if it's a human being, it's a human being, and you can't go around killing human beings, right? All right. Well, then why aren't they lined up outside of in vitro fertilization clinics protesting the fact that thousands of embryos are discarded all the time there? Well, they're not, are they? Then we get to the stem cell issue. All right. So there are two basic ways that you can derive embryonic stem cells. You can do it by borrowing from the in vitro fertilization clinics. The leftover embryos that are going to be discarded, you can use those for research. It's not the best way to go because you don't have your choice of cells that are actually married to some particular disease that you want to study or map the development of, but it's better than nothing. And Barack Obama now has freed up federal money to use in research on those embryos, but not the more useful ones. The more useful embryos are the ones that are actually created in the lab, that are tied to a certain person who has a certain condition or disease. That's what we really need to be studying here. Okay, so a political compromise is reached. People like Orrin Hatch, very conservative, Republican-sorted person, anti-choice and all that, he thinks, all right, we'll have a political compromise. We will allow federal money for research using the IVF embryos, but not the laboratory embryos. Well, what is the moral distinction there? I mean, I'm fine with either of them being used. I'd rather the more useful ones were used. But why are we making this distinction? Now, think about it. In the case of the IVF embryos, you've got sperm meeting egg, an actual conception taking place, albeit with a little technical help. It creates a unique genetic entity, which is expressly created for the purpose of creating a human life. But apparently those are okay as long as they're left over and they're going to be discarded. We can do research on those, according to people like Orrin Hatch. Now, on the other side, on the laboratory side, sperm never meets egg. There is no conception. What you have is a donor egg with its nucleus removed, ergo its DNA removed. So now you've got a blank egg. You've got an egg white, basically. And then sperm never enters the picture. And no, I'm not going in the oral sex direction. I think there's a single mention of oral sex in this entire thing. No, not at all. But so anyway, no sperm involved in this. Instead, we take your skin cell. We take your skin cell, we replace the nucleus of that egg with that skin cell, bathe it with some chemicals, and magically, it behaves as if a conception has taken place and begins to divide. But in fact, there's no intention to create a new life. It isn't a unique genetic entity. It's you. It's essentially you. And I know, cloning, that makes people freak out a little bit. It's never going to get out of a petri dish. There is no chance ever of this becoming a human being. And yet, they put more moral weight and value on these embryos. Well, what sense does that make? Not only doesn't it make scientific sense, it doesn't make any moral sense either. If you're going to make a distinction, and I wouldn't, but if you're going to make a distinction, wouldn't you credit the IVF embryos a little more than the laboratory embryos? I would think so, but apparently not. Religionists are very sensitive around the idea that people must respect their beliefs, of course. Well, I certainly respect their right to hold whatever beliefs they choose. Absolutely. Fight to the death for your right to believe whatever you choose. But I have to say, I do take issue with the notion that the belief itself is something that I am obliged to credit. If you... If you want to believe the earth is flat, be my guest. You know, you have every right to do that. Just don't expect me to play along with that. I don't enjoy being rude to anybody, but when people use the shield of religion to justify bigotry, that is definitely not worthy of respect. Now, I do a radio show on Air America every day, and we talk about that wasn't really meant to be an applause line. I was just letting you know I do a show. But and we deal with a variety of issues, of course, and sometimes I take calls, and religion is introduced into the topic. For instance, we talk about gay marriage, or if you prefer, and I do, marriage rights for gay people, because there is no such thing as gay marriage as opposed to straight marriage. There's just marriage. And the question is, can everybody enjoy that right or not? And inevitably, we'll get some calls about that, and somebody will start talking about the immorality of homosexuality and the abomination of homosexuality and how it's just such a terrible thing and all that. Now, they can never tell you exactly what the harm would be in letting gay couples marry. I've asked them explicitly. I've challenged, in fact, my entire audience. I said, anybody, call up, tell me what harm would actually come, and they can't. Nobody does. Nobody ever does. But nevertheless, they will bring up religion, of course. Religion gets into it. It's an abomination. Leviticus and all that sort of thing. And I tell them that their religion is none of my business, and I don't need to hear it, and it's nobody else's business either, and their private belief is their own business, and that's fine, and they can keep it to themselves. But, of course, that doesn't satisfy them. So I try this. All right. Your God says that, your religion says that gay couples should not be allowed to marry. Well, my God and my religion, which I'm sort of making up, of course, but my God and my religion say we have to let gay couples marry. Now, where does that leave us? Does your God and my God go out back into the parking lot and just duke it out? Now, my God wins, gay couples get to marry. If your God wins, okay, not. I guess I see what you're saying there. I said, well, okay. So what do you say we don't use religion to determine this question? What do you say we look at some other document to decide whether gay couples ought to be allowed to marry or not? How about the U.S. Constitution? I say, you find me someplace in the U.S. Constitution where it says that gay people are supposed to be treated differently than everybody else, and I'm all ears. Go ahead. Find it for me. That pretty much ends that conversation right there, because, of course, there is nothing in the Constitution that would say that. But people, people get very exercised about all this sort of stuff, and... It's a little sad. I'm glad you brought up, Phil, I'm glad you brought up torture. I think it is remarkable that one of the most self-avowedly religious presidents in our history, at least recent history, would be the first president of the United States to ever institute torture as policy in this country. And that is the distinction that we have to make. Listen, people have done horrible things in wars from the get-go. That's just a given. People have been tortured in wars and things like that. But never, never in United States history was it a policy of this country to treat people in that way. You know, from the time of George Washington, and George Washington was, he was fighting for his own life. Not only was he fighting for a country, he was fighting for his very life. Had he lost that war,
Had he been captured by the British, he'd have been strung up for sedition. So this, you know, a lot was on the line for old George there. And the British troops were, in fact, torturing and abusing the colonists. They'd find, they'd tar and feather them, they'd hang them in the public square, they'd do all sorts of things. And, you know, the Continental Army, people involved in the Continental Army, were coming to Washington and the other founding fathers and saying, you know, turnabout's fair play. You know, we're getting trashed here. We ought to be, you know, if we capture some Brits, we ought to be doing the same thing to them. And Washington said, no, no. He said, better we show the world how a free people conduct themselves. And that was the tradition in this country. Washington, Lincoln, Eisenhower, Roosevelt, all of them. Nobody would countenance torture. And that includes my own father, who proudly signed a UN resolution obliging countries not only not to torture, but to turn over to international courts or their own courts, if they chose, torturers in their midst. And he called it an abomination and would have no part of it. But our very religious President George W. Bush, apparently, and the perhaps not-so-religious Dick Cheney, apparently thought that torturing people was just fine. Now, I don't want to take up too much time here, and I know I want to do a few questions because it's more fun that way. It's more fun for me, and it's no doubt more fun for you too. But let me just wonder, speculate. What is the future for our little band of non-believers? We atheists, people will believe what they wish, always have, always will. They'll go on fearing and loathing folks who don't share those beliefs. The fear often masquerading as pity, as you know. I always love that, the sort of patronizing attitude that they feel sorry for you, that you're not a member of their religion. I've always seen this this sort of thing as testament to their own insecurities about their faith, by the way. I think people despise atheists, those that do, anyway, because they're terrified about the weakness, frankly, of their own faith. And we are a rebuke to them that they would rather do without, frankly. We introduced a little reality that they'd just as soon avoid. But I do believe that the time is on our side. Now, it may take a long time, but I think time is on our side. Religions may persist, but they come and they go. Where are the old Norse gods today? Where are the worshippers of Amun-Ra today? 1,000 years from now, what will people make of a man tortured to death on a cross, of a prophet who is said to ride a white horse up to a mythical heaven? What will our distant progeny think of claims by some that they have a special, exclusive compact with a deity? We can only wonder what our progeny will think of that. Well, I'm no prophet. I can't read the future, certainly. But I am certain of one thing. Reason and free thought will remain a hallmark of the human species. The ability of human beings to gaze out at the wondrous, baffling universe in which we find ourselves with minds uncluttered by dogma has been and always will be the measure of our success. Faith will fade, religions will flower and vanish, but reason remains. Reason is where I put my faith, if you will. Reason is where I stand. And I am happy to stand there with you. Thank you very much. Thank you. I don't know what the time frame is or constraints. I know there's cake out there, so I don't want to keep you away from that. I'd love to. Anybody has any questions? That's fine. I'll do my best to answer. Can't make any promises, but I'll do my best. Yes, ma'am. There you go. Wonder if the scouts know about that. Why? Yes, sir.
Hi. I wanted to comment a little bit about your challenge to your callers on the subject of gay rights to find something in the Constitution to support their position. Mm-hmm. The Constitution certainly is a great document, but it's not flawless. And I think one of my favorite parts of being a free thinker is that I am under no obligation to treat any document or Indeed. Line of thought as inerrant. Yeah. The Constitution, for example, while it does not abridge the rights of gays, it does state that people other than free should have only 3/5 representation.
I recognize.
And I think we would all agree that that is a morally repugnant position today. My point is, if the Constitution hypothetically did abridge the rights of gays, for me, that would not prove that gay rights should be abridged. It would only prove that the Constitution should be amended.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's no question about that. I didn't want to... I didn't want to imply that the Constitution was a perfect document. Clearly, it was not. It's an artifact of its era, and I think even the founders knew that it was deficient in many ways and hypocritical, frankly, in some respects. But the point remains that there's nothing in there that implies in any way that homosexuals should be treated any differently than anybody else. Our foundational documents say that all people, well, they say all men, but of course we interpret that as all people, were created equal. Straight, gay, anything else. That's the way I feel about it. So, yeah.
Thanks.
Yes, sir.
Hi. Since you've probably known a lot of well-known people through your life, having your father as a, you know, someone who's also probably brought them into it.
Yeah.
Would you say that you've met a lot of people who can't show their atheism? Some well-known people like other talk show hosts, like politicians and stuff. There seems to be a lot of people who give me the impression that they're probably closet atheists because for money reasons they probably are hiding it.
Yeah, I think that is probably true. Now, I can't say that I've had anybody, some well-known celebrity come up to me and say in so many words, I'm an atheist, but I'm not going to let anybody know. But I imagine that that's true, and I also imagine, though, that there are many other people, celebrity or not, who just don't give it a lot of thought, but if they did, would probably recognize that at the very least they're agnostic, if not actually atheist. I think that the number of people who could be in this room is actually much larger than the number that is in this room. I know that the nuns now, as they call N-O-N-E-S, account for about 15% of our country in the last survey. Fastest growing group, I believe. Phil, you probably know about this better than I would. But I suspect even that is understated. Well,
I sometimes suspect Mr. Obama could be, because he said he was early in his life.
Yeah,
you know, and then he gained religion, I think, for political reasons.
Well, yeah, I can't speak to that in particular, but certainly politicians would be loath to, for obvious reasons that we've covered already, admit their atheism.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
Thank you, Ron, for sharing your thoughts with us today.
Sure.
And I think a lot of us, like he just said, are probably a little fearful of having certain politicians that are espousing their beliefs and using their religious beliefs to have personal agendas or to try to bring on Armageddon or whatever.
Right.
I have a question about, during the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall, did your father consider it a personal victory against a godless nation, or that anything that he did was the Christians won and the godless nation fell?
If you had gotten into a discussion with him about Soviet communism, for instance, he certainly at some point would have mentioned godlessness. But that was not his primary focus. His obsession during his presidency with the Soviet Union in particular had a lot to do with nuclear weapons. And mainly, he saw the American people and the Russian people, Soviet people at that time, as really being quite comparable. And he was horrified by the idea. And this was perhaps the primary motivating factor in his presidency, certainly into his second term. He was obsessed by the idea that we were caught in this trap of mutually assured destruction, where if, you know, something had gone wrong, some misunderstanding, an accident even, and missiles were launched,
that a president of the United States would have virtually no choice but to launch in response, thereby killing millions and millions of other people over there. He didn't want to do that. He certainly didn't want any Americans being killed like that. But that was the thing that got him the most. It was a more humanistic concern, really, that we've got to get away from this idea of, you know, having a gun to each other's heads, basically. And so that's why he made the offer at Reykjavik, which, you know, it didn't pan out exactly, because he wasn't willing to give up the missile defense shield. But I've often wondered what would have happened if Gorbachev had not insisted on the missile defense shield being the price of getting rid of all nuclear weapons, or almost all nuclear weapons. I suspect, frankly, that somebody back here in the United States would have, one way or the other, put a stop to it themselves. Somebody in the military-industrial complex would not have allowed that to happen.
It just seems interesting that our fear of other countries having nuclear weapons, and yet we're the only country that's ever used one.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, indeed. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Ron, for your speech. And I was listening to your program, I think it was yesterday, and there was a Christian called in and said, his Jesus never taught to kill another human being, and I don't think that's true. Is it, Dan? Dan would know.
What was the, because I can never remember. Once the show is over, it's like just disappears from my mind. I can't remember anything that happened yesterday.
He, being a Christian, was bettering himself over the Islam religion. He said his God, Jesus, did not mention or even taught killing another human being. And that's not true, is it?
I don't, Dan, you may know better than I don't remember Jesus ever mentioning killing anybody. He was a little mean to his mother occasionally.
Didn't Jesus say that if they do not believe in me, bring them to me and they should be...
I don't think Jesus.
Since
ever,
I don't own, you know, a Bible anymore, I wasn't able to look it up.
You know, you maybe. I obviously we know about Deuteronomy and the idea of if your child is apostate, then you're supposed to stone them to death.
Oh, so then maybe he was correct then.
Yeah.
Oh.
Dan will get together. We'll resolve that theological issue.
All right. Sir. Thank you for your talk. I have a question. How come you haven't run for president?
Because I'm an atheist. I wouldn't do that anyway.
Yeah, now you made that statement before, and you gave the answer, and I'm up there hearing you talk, and I'm thinking to myself, what a great thing, and a political candidate shoved this in everybody's face, like you do.
Yeah,
Run for a candidate. You may not win, but at least you're going to push this in everybody's face and have them think about it.
Well, that's fair enough. I'm not running for office just because I'm an atheist. I don't want to.
But you have a great idea.
And I happen to be an atheist, which kind of gets me off the hook anyway. But I appreciate the vote of confidence. Yes, sir.
Thanks. Great talk. Quick question. You're the Republican coalition of the 80s, of course, included Christian conservatives, the religious right, but it also included national defense hawks, economic conservatives, some people who were pretty libertarian about social issues.
Yeah.
So do you think it's you can have a viable Republican candidate today who doesn't either pretend to be an evangelical Christian or at the very least adhere to a dogmatic set of social policy positions?
The short answer would be no. That is in part because the Republican Party has now moved so far to the right and has been so co-opted by the religious right that, and on top of that, and particularly in the House of Representatives, exclusively in the House of Representatives, because we're talking about gerrymandering, has gerrymandered districts, some of which look like some kind, you know, amoebas and all kinds of things, expressly to create these conservative enclaves. They use marketing data and things to literally get down as granular as street by street, block by block, house by house, just as marketers do to decide, you know, who can we sell our stuff to in various neighborhoods, where should we put our advertising dollars. Politicians do the same thing here, and they have used that kind of data to gerrymander these districts. which guarantees that on the Republican side, you're going to have extreme conservatives. And extreme conservatism tends to go along with that evangelical religious perspective. So right now, no, in the Republican Party, unless you were going to toe the line about, abortion and all the other social issues, gay marriage, you wouldn't stand much of a chance. Look at what happened to Didi Scozzafava in New York's 23rd district. I mean, she was a bit socially progressive, and to the extent that she wasn't anti-choice, well, that was it. She was out of the race, and they went with this conservative guy, Doug Hoffman, instead, who, you know, said all the right things and, of course, got his butt kicked there. And New York 23rd, first time since Ulysses S. Grant that the New York 23rd went Democratic instead of Republican. So doesn't always pan out for the Republicans that way. Yes, sir?
Just real quickly, I couldn't let it slip by. You alluded to the tragedy of American policy where it's related to torture. And I just wanted to make quick mention that it's nice to have transitioned so quickly from abomination to Obama nation.
Yes. Yes, sir?
I'm just still curious about the present circumstance of the belief of your siblings. As to where they sort of stand and how they feel towards you and all that.
I'm not quite sure where my sister stands these days. She was sort of a Jesus Christ Superstar Christian during the 60s and 70s, and I suspect that she's still kind of in that country. My brother Mike, who is also a radio host, is a very devout evangelical Christian, and he and I obviously don't see eye to eye on those sorts of things and generally avoid that topic altogether whenever we're...
I mean, you still manage to somehow communicate and get along sometimes?
We don't actually speak that much, I have to, have to admit. It's just one of those family things, I guess. So. Anyway, listen, thank you again. Thank you for having me here. Appreciate it very much. And thank you once again for this. It was an honored place in my home.